Welcome to my TED Talk on 7 casually racist things that white writers do. Actually, it's not my TED Talk. I don't know if you even bothered to pay attention to what you were clicking on, but this is actually a podcast where today we're going to be talking about the other. What is this mysterious other, and what does it have to do with race and gender? Also, should white writers be writing characters of color, or should they not? Let's get into it.
Warning, the following program contains critical thinking, honest opinions, viewpoints on culture that may seem conservative, and a positive view on absolute detestable things such as marriage and children. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Subtle Rampage Podcast, where we discuss the things that I feel like discussing. Sometimes it's things of a political nature, sometimes it's things of a cultural nature. Usually it's both. I'm your host, Adelia Kirchner, and today I'm going to be testing out a new segment of sorts. For episodes with words or terms or phrases that I feel like, you know, should or need to be broken down, explained, defined, whatever. This idea has kind of been sitting in my notes since the inception of this podcast. So without further ado, my fellow humans, let's have a mental breakdown where we mentally break down our words for the day. So I've got two terms for us to mentally break down today. The first one is more confusing than the second one, so we'll go ahead and get that one out of the way. The other. This mysterious other. The first time I remember hearing this term or coming across this term outside of like casual classroom discussion in university where people would just kind of throw it around and I didn't really understand that it was like this big concept that people used. The first time I actually like came across a definition of it of sorts was when I had to read Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex for one of my psychology classes, in which de Beauvoir references an essay titled Time and the Other. And she writes, "The category of other is as original as consciousness itself. The duality between self and other can be found in the most primitive societies, in the most ancient mythologies. This division did not always fall into the category of the division of the sexes. It was not based on any empirical given." She goes on to note that no group ever defines itself as one without immediately setting up the other opposite itself. She says, "It only takes three travelers brought together by chance in the same train compartment for the rest of the travelers to become vaguely hostile others. Village people view anyone not belonging to the village as suspicious others. For the native of a country, inhabitants of other countries are viewed as foreigners. Jews are the others for anti-Semites, blacks for racist Americans, indigenous people for colonists, and proletarians for the propertied classes." So there's that. I believe that it's following, I think it's pronounced Hegel or Heigel or something. I don't remember, but it's like H-E-G-E-L. Okay, he's a big philosophy dude. Go look him up. He comes right up on Google. Anyways, I believe that it's by following his philosophy that de Beauvoir concludes that a fundamental hostility to any other consciousness is found in consciousness itself. The subject posits itself only in opposition, it asserts itself as the essential, and sets up the other as inessential, as the object. So in modern layman's terms, we're pretty much talking main character energy here, but on a larger, often group scale. Later, de Beauvoir summarizes this concept by writing that no subject posits itself spontaneously and at once as the inessential from the outset. It is not the other who, defining itself as other, defines the one. The other is posited as other by the one positing itself as one. So the only person or group that can cause the other to exist as the other is the party that defined themselves as the one in the first place, which results in their naturally having to be a party that is the other. the author of the foreword to the 1986 edition, okay, it's that particular edition foreword, okay, of Franz Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks. Terrible book. I hate it so much. It's horrible to read. And then the ideology behind it is just as bad. But, like, the writing is just painful to get through. Maybe if you're, like, super academic and you read, like, that type of philosophic stuff all the time, it won't be as bad, but it's just terrible to read. I don't recommend it. But the author of this foreword sort of criticizes Fanon just a little bit, not really, but just a little bit, saying that he is too quick to name the other. I guess Fanon doesn't make the other mysterious enough in his musings, because Fanon says that the real other for the white man is and will continue to be the black man. And apparently that is too specifically defining the other. Whatever. Apologies. I'm sure this is a lot of what sounds like word vomit to you guys. But before we got into what I want to talk about today, I just thought it would be helpful for everyone to at least slightly understand this concept of the other. It's a concept that's extremely prevalent in academia, as well as in feminist movement, like literature, I guess, and in the neo-Marxist movement of critical race theory. This concept of the other shows up in what I would guess is the majority of published works that discuss feminism, sex, gender, race, racism, colonialism, anything like that from a progressive standpoint. But let's get into the second term I want to define today, and that is racism. Now, you're probably like, why do we need to define racism? Well, I'll tell you. There's been a lot of discourse in recent years here in the United States over the redefining of words in our overwhelmingly pleasant Western world. Think the redefining of what a vaccine is, for starters. But focusing on the definition of racism specifically, I flipped through a few of my print dictionaries just to see how racism was defined by dictionary publishers at various points in recent history, and I'd like to go over some of those definitions with you guys. So, the 1978 print of the 1958 Webster's Encyclopedia of Dictionaries, the New America edition, which was printed on acid paper, by the way, so it just falls apart more and more every time that I open it, defines racism simply as animosity shown to peoples of different race. The 1998 edition of Random House Webster's Dictionary defines racism as a belief that one's own race is superior, and a policy or practice based on racism. Yes, it could be argued that the second definition is synonymous with the concept of systemic racism. However, it's pretty vague and could apply to the policies and practices of an individual, whether that's in daily life, business dealings, whatever. So it's just not really specific enough for me, I don't think. Anyways. Then we move on to the 2002 New International Webster's Dictionary, which defines racism as belief in the inborn superiority of a racial group. And 2015's fifth edition of Webster's Dictionary for Students defines racism as the belief that certain races of people are by birth and nature superior to others. And then it also defines racism as discrimination or hatred based on race. Now, like I kind of mentioned, okay, in the United States, we've come across a bit of an issue lately where one chunk of the population is defining racism as we just defined it, and the other chunk of the population, the one that has a larger academic and social influence, if you ask me, is defining racism in a whole new way. So to contrast these older dictionaries, let's look at how the Merriam-Webster dictionary currently defines racism. The first definition on there is that racism is a belief that race is a fundamental determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. Also, behavior or attitudes that reflect and foster this belief, racial discrimination or prejudice. The second definition is that racism is the systemic oppression of a racial group to the social, economic, and political advantage of another, and this definition specifically references and links to white supremacy. And then you get the last definition that's up on their website right now, which is that racism is a political or social system founded on racism and designed to execute its principles. So, if you actually listened to all of what I just said, you probably noticed a key difference in the base definition of racism right now and what it was less than 10 years ago and so on. Now, our definition of racism is literally systemic racism. The systemic component may have been conceivable using older definitions, but it is now blatantly a part of our definition. On that note, okay, some of y'all may recall in your distant recent memory, whatever you want to call it, go all the way back to 2018. See if you can remember a book by a certain lady, certain white lady named Robin DiAngelo. I'm talking about white fragility. Yes. And I feel like around that time, a lot of people in progressive circles started to pick up that book and similar ones like Me and White Supremacy, stuff like that. Hence that chunk of the population taking on this definition of racism that is laid out in those books. According to DiAngelo in White Fragility, she says, "Our simplistic definition of racism as intentional acts of racial discrimination committed by immoral individuals engenders a confidence that we are not part of the problem and that our learning is thus complete." Because if she doesn't completely make up a reason for people to listen to what she has to say, nobody would have felt like they had to pick up the book, right? Right. DiAngelo also makes an attempt to subdue the more skeptical readers like myself by saying, "No, I'm not calling you racist. I would never. OMG, I can't believe that you thought that that's what I was saying, even though that's literally what I said. Stop it, girls, stop it. No, seriously, stop." Anyways, she does this, okay, by saying that, to be clear, if your definition of a racist is someone who holds conscious dislike of people because of race, then I agree that it is offensive for me to suggest that you are racist when I do not know you. I also agree that if this is your definition of racism and you are against racism, then you are not racist. Now breathe. Oh, okay. All right. Quick break here, guys. Madame DiAngelo has instructed us to breathe, so you should probably do that. She seems to really know what she's talking about here. But she goes on to clarify that she is not using this definition of racism, and her book goes on to explain that the definition of racism she's actually using is that racism actually occurs when a racial group's prejudice is backed by a legal authority and institutional control. DiAngelo, like a lot of other people in our country now, defines racism as simply the broader concept of systemic racism. As if the terms racism and systemic racism cannot possibly each have their own definitions and coexist within the same timeline. Because of this definition and the inaccurate assumption that only white people control the institutions of power and can possibly make legislation or do anything in this country, DiAngelo claims that racism is deeply embedded in the fabric of our society. It is not limited to a single act or person, nor does it move back and forth, one day benefiting whites, and another day or even era, benefiting people of color. She claims that while people of color may hold prejudices and discriminate against white people, they lack the social and institutional power that transforms their prejudice and discrimination into racism, noting that the impact of their prejudice on whites is temporary and contextual. So take from that what you will. I hope that you're not too worked up yet, because we still have some infuriating stuff to work through today. But to sort of preface the articles that I want to talk about today, let's get into a bit of backstory here on how exactly I came across these particular articles on casually racist things that white writers do, etc. Okay. I use this writer's resource, whatever you want to call it. It's called Shut Up and Write. It's just like, just type it into Google, it'll come up. It's kind of a nifty little thing. It's kind of like a Zoom study group for those of you COVID era students. But you pretty much, you register for an event, you get on there, you say, hey, this is where I'm writing from, and this is what I'm gonna get done in the next hour or two. And everybody says that, and then you actually just work with all these people on Zoom and nobody talks. And then you come back in the chat pretty much and you're like, hey, I did what I was supposed to do, or hey, I didn't do what I was supposed to do. But I find it really helpful when I have articles for the newspaper that I don't really particularly want to write, or I'm just not in the writing mood. It's a nice little thing. It's a nice little thing. But anyways, my point being, not to promote this website that is definitely left-leaning, but anyways, the point is that there's something coming up in November called National Novel Writing Month. And for those of you who don't know, there is an organization for this national novel writing thing. And pretty much a bunch of people get together every year in November, virtually, in person, whatever they can swing. And they spend the entire month of November drafting 50,000 words for whatever their work in progress is, whatever novel that they want to write. And, you know, a lot of people don't make it to 50,000 words. There's a decent amount of people that do. I personally think that November is possibly the worst month they could have picked to have a 50,000 word writing challenge, especially for students. You know, that's kind of like right after midterms, and like you have a month to write this first draft of a book, but then finals are coming up in like usually the first week of December, right? So it's just really bad timing for students. And then even if you're not a student, November is just like a really bad month to like work on like a different project like that, because holidays, family, stuff like that. I don't know. It's just a weird month for them to have picked. But yes, sorry, side rant over, got a little sidetracked there. Anyways, so with that event coming up, the people on Shut Up and Write, the population has kind of differed a little bit. There's a bunch of people who are going to be participating in this National Novel Writing Month that are now using Shut Up and Write all of a sudden because they're getting into that mindset and getting ready to write a bunch of words every day. And so one of the ladies a few weeks ago in one of the events I attended, she was like kind of sharing some resources for people who are going to be working on novels. And so she shared one that I thought sounded kind of interesting. It's called Writing the Other. And so I was like, you know what? I'm gonna go check this out. I figured that it was gonna be pretty much all resources on how to write LGBTQ plus characters and characters who aren't white. That's what I figured, but I was also maybe stupidly hoping for there to be some sort of articles or resources on, you know, how to write characters of different socioeconomic backgrounds or period piece characters, stuff like that. You know, just to shake it up a little bit, you know, not be so focused on the race and gender stuff. But there are resources for the socioeconomic stuff and the period piece stuff, but not in the same way. It's more so you can go out to their site and find resources on how to research, and then you can go research those things. There's not specific articles that I found on anything other than LGBTQ plus characters and racism stuff. Yeah, so let's get into the thing that I want to actually talk about, guys. 7 casually racist things that white authors do. So I found this article on the Writing the Other website. It's one of the many links that they promote and, you know, encourage you to click on to learn more as a white writer. This title just caught my eye and I was like, I should read that. And then I read it. And I was like, I should do a podcast on that. I feel like this would make people a little angry, like it did with me. And so, you know, you're welcome, guys. But this is an article from 2018. You could argue that it's outdated, but I'll get into why it's not in a bit. So let's just read it real quick. Real quick, I say, but it'll probably be a few minutes. Let's just read it. They start off, in response to the inevitable backlash from the title, yes, I realize it is not all white authors. In fact, some white authors do an amazing job of writing about race by doing research, being respectful, and understanding what lines not to cross. It indeed can be done. Shocker. They go on to say that they're a longtime reader, and they say, before I committed to reaching out and finding more authors of color to read, I read a bunch of white authors. Heck, they make up the majority of published writers. Even if you don't try to read all white people, you end up doing so anyway unless you actively search for authors of color. Now, I'll bring this up again probably in a minute, but my question with that statement, like, you know, that there's more white authors who've been published than any other authors, I guess, is my question is, what does the pool of writers look like that is actively seeking a publisher? Like, you know, I feel like there's a lot more factors. Like, one, there's a lot of white people in the U.S. There's probably a lot of white people in the U.K., if we're including that. So I'm just kind of like, you know, I feel like there's a lot more white people in a lot of professions. So why would writing be the exception to that when you have a huge white population in comparison to some of the other races that are in America? But that's kind of my question there. And there's also like other like societal factors. I'm like, you know, one, okay, if there are more white people in the country than there are, say, black people, because I'm pretty sure this writer is black. So there are more chances for there to be more families that encourage their, you know, children to do what they love. When there is a bigger population, there's going to be more, like a higher number of families that encourages that. A smaller population, you're going to naturally have a smaller amount of families that encourage that. I mean, how many people, like if you stack the numbers up against each other, how many people in each racial group in the US are actually, you know, pursuing writing as a career and pursuing a publisher for their book? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm completely off here, but I just kind of feel like that might be part of the reason why there are more published white authors. The other thing is here, are we talking more published, right, like more published white authors, like dating back centuries? Or are we talking about like within the last decade, within the last 20 years? Because if we're talking about, you know, before things were the way they are now, like if we're talking back before people were, you know, letting their slaves like learn how to read and stuff, then yeah, you know, it makes sense that there were more white published authors. But now I feel like the rates can't be that bad. Like the comparison can't be that bad now. I don't know. Again, maybe I'm entirely off. I didn't go look at any studies or anything because I don't really care too much about that one particular point. But this person goes on to say, during my time of reading white authors, I internalized a lot of bad things. Some of these I probably still haven't unlearned, and they've hurt me in myriad ways as I grew and learned to accept myself. What specifically am I referring to? Thanks for asking. I made a list. And then we get into the first of the seven casually racist things that white authors do. Okay. One, there aren't any people of color in your giant 400-page long book that literally has fire-breathing dragons. Maybe if you're a person of color, you've experienced this. You're halfway through a book and you realize there aren't any people of color at all. And it takes place where? New York City? Wow. And then she says, people of color can be heroes, can be villains, but not only villains, can be the protagonist of a mainstream book. Why are we not represented more accurately? And I don't know, I feel like this has been a debate in multiple forms of media, not just books. This has been a debate in movies and TV shows, things like that. And, you know, there's the whole thing of like race swapping, you know, the Snow White controversy, the The Little Mermaid controversy, all the controversies with Disney, right? My thing is kind of like, I don't bat an eye or blink an eye or whatever the saying is when I come across a story that is by somebody of a different race that does not include any white people. I literally do not bat an eye. You know why? Because I don't expect everything to be catered to me. And I also realize that, you know, just because I might write a story with a particular character does not mean that somebody else is going to write that particular character. I don't understand. I also am somebody who doesn't have a problem if somebody writes a story or writes a screenplay or whatever that is all men. I don't have a problem with that. Because you know why? Because sometimes it doesn't matter, okay? Sometimes it doesn't matter. So, yeah. The first casually racist thing that white authors do is not including any people of color in their story. Number two, white is the color of everything good and pure, and black is the color of everything bad and evil. I guess I can't really attack some of the first culprits of this trend, this writer says, referencing the Bible, which she says, unfortunately, is filled with this rhetoric and was used to justify slavery and colonialism for centuries. Because those writers are long gone, but it's centuries later. You'd think we would see the problem with always associating white with the definition of good and holy and black with the evil and sin. Sorry, I kind of butchered reading that little passage, but oh well. I don't think anybody cares about this, like, because personally, yeah, we use the terms white and black here in America. It's very nice. When really most black people are not actually the color black. Like, I'm talking in our country, okay? Most of them are not just straight up black. Most of them are not even as dark as the beanie I'm wearing right now, which is a dark gray. I understand that there's undertones to people's skin and stuff, but I'm serious here, okay? Most black people are not black. Most white people are not actually white. Okay, that's just the reality. So to, I don't know, to insinuate that these two things are related is just stupid to me. Three, when introducing characters, only the non-white races are mentioned. And then she brings up a sentence such as this: the children at the school, two of whom are black, etc., etc. And says, the statement above predicates whiteness as the default. Too many authors never point out a character's race until it's a character of color, as if the reader should assume all characters are white until proven otherwise. Now, personally, I don't think that this is the racism hill that anybody should really die on. like, what if a person of color wrote a book and only mentioned race or color when they were introducing their white characters? Like, does it really matter? Is it really the end of the world? Maybe it's a little weird, but is it the end of the world? No. But I do agree with this point in the sense that there should be nuance to your writing, especially if you're at the point where you're publishing a book. You should, if you're gonna mention the skin color, like, directly, you're gonna be like, oh, these black kids. Okay, if you're gonna do that, then at least be consistent and call it out for all of your characters, no matter what race they are or color they are, whatever. But I personally think that that's kind of lazy writing. Why don't you just go about it in a more nuanced way? Make it clear through showing, okay, who these characters are, what their life is like, how their friends interact with them, like, their experiences, like, show their culture or their race through the story. That's better writing to me. You don't have to do it like that, but that's better writing to me when I read a book. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I know what this person looks like now. And they didn't even have to specifically spell it out for me, like, I'm 2 years old. That's crazy. So that's just kind of my thoughts on that. Number four on the list of things that white authors do that are racist, okay? Describing people of color using food. Miss Smith had the skin of color caramel. Or the girl brought her coffee-colored hands to her face in wonder. She says, so with these sentences above, it might not seem that cringy until you realize two things. One, these types of descriptions are usually only applied to people of color. And two, people of color have had a history of being used for slave labor involving food, especially coffee, chocolate, and so on. The words you use have historical context. I don't have much to say on that one, except for, who cares? Most races have been enslaved at some point in time, and most slaves handled agricultural stuff and resources and food. Moving on to racist thing number five, not doing research on a culture/dialect. The example sentence here is, "And then Jerry said, 'Oh yeah, homie, I totally dig you, my man, for sure.'" Or it doesn't even say "for sure." Okay, it's "for show, for show." I can't even pronounce that. Anyways, I don't know if this is a real line of dialogue from an actual book or anything, but it's just kind of bad writing. Because even if those are words that somebody actually said, because I'm not saying there are definitely people who talk like this, but just the way that dialogue is written is really bad. Anyways, the author of this article says, "Every time I see Black English / Ebonics / AAVE in a book done badly, a part of me dies. Black people in our language is not a messed up version of standard English. Black English is a dialect of English, one to be studied and researched thoroughly, just like any other dialect of any other language." And then goes on to say, "Just respect the people, the culture, and do your research." I don't even have anything to say on that, so whatever. Number six, stereotypes. Yeah, I don't have much to say here either. We've talked about this on my podcast before. Stereotypes are not, I think I slipped up on my words there. Stereotypes are not always applicable, but they do exist for a reason, okay? Also, race stereotypes, okay, those are not the only stereotypes that are, like, used in books and storytelling and TV and stuff. And actually, I would argue that there are, like, other stereotypes are even more overused than racial stereotypes at this point. So I think we're already, like, getting past that, so I don't understand why this is even on this list. Number seven, The White Savior. "I really could do without another book / movie / anything where the white person saves the natives because they can't fend for themselves. Or perhaps a white person wants to teach a black man to take care of himself and play football, like in The Blind Side. Just one story like this doesn't hurt, but when the trope is constant in the mainstream media, it's a problem. It infantilizes people of color and gives them no agency or respect." I don't know. I feel like... Okay, what about the trope of the low-income kid who grows up on the shady east side or the shady west side or the, like, not-so-great part of town, right? What about the low-income kid and then the family that, like, either adopts this low-income kid, fosters this low-income kid, or just randomly takes in this low-income kid that already has parents and he just goes, or she just goes and lives with this family for the next however long the series goes on in a TV show, right? Like, what about that trope? Because I've seen that, like, several times, and I'm like, so if the low-income character is black, then the stereotype is bad? I'm just kind of, what? Like, then it's white saviorism? I mean, I feel like there can be kind of the same problems if it's a white family taking in a white low-income kid, you know, like, because it's like, you know, they could just be good people and they could just be offering him an opportunity or her an opportunity, or it could be that they do get a sense of like, oh, we're doing something so good and we're like really saving this kid from, you know, a terrible life. Like, there can be the same attitude regardless of race, so... I mean, I know it's not exactly the same, but I'm just kind of sitting here like, I don't know. I just feel like it's not that big of a thing. I feel like the having a trope in media doesn't necessarily, like, warrant it being on this list, I guess. I mean, I do understand the natives thing. Like, if we're... I understand if we try to rewrite history... in storytelling, like, if it's supposed to be accurate to what happened in real life, and it's kind of, like, written in a way that isn't accurate, then I understand the problem. But, yeah, just in general, I don't know. Okay, so that's kind of the end of that. In conclusion, this lady says, nobody's perfect, but some people don't even try to be better. White authors, we all live in a terrifying time. People of color's rights and dignity are on the line. We all have to work together to dismantle inequality from the big things to the little ones. If all you can do is be more conscious while writing what you love, then do your part. I'll be waiting. Aw, that's very sweet. That's very nice of her to wait on us. So that was that article, but then, considering it was in 2018 that was posted, I was like, well, let me just Google real quick, okay? I'm just gonna Google real quick racist things that white authors do. And one of the first things that popped up when I did that was I got this article titled, White Authors Writing POC, People of Color, Everything You Ever Wanted to Not Know. And this is a bit of a longer article, but it was posted in February of 2021, and so it's a bit more recent, and yeah, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but we'll read some parts of it, because I don't want to sit here and repeat everything that the other article said. But it starts off, this person goes, "Hey there, white authors! Have you ever wanted to write characters of color or feature POC cultures or ethnicities in your books? Have you been too afraid to do so because you feel like this is a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation? Well, this post is here to hopefully answer some of your questions. Instead of bothering POC authors, bloggers, and other content creators on Twitter or Instagram, asking them to do the free labor of educating you, grab a seat, a drink, and a snack, and pursue this handy guide, or peruse this handy guide on white authors writing POC. All opinions and thoughts presented in this post were shaped and informed by experiences that we had as queer POC bloggers, as well as the conversations between POC and the bookish and publishing community." Splendid. So there's our initial paragraph, right? And then we get into the rest of the article. And once again, we have the subject of how publishing still heavily favors white authors. And another thing that I meant to bring up earlier on this point is similar to like how college scholarships are, where there's just a lot of scholarships that are only available to specifically Hispanic students or specifically Black students or specifically like any other race other than people who are classified as white, right? That's also the case in the writing world when it comes to writing grants, writing fellowships, some publishing programs. Like a lot of that stuff is out there specifically for writers who are people of color or whatever. So I don't know. I feel like there's still a lot of ways to be published as an author who is not white. So I really don't see that as a valid complaint. Okay. Next on the list of things that I highlighted in this article, only people of color seem to face consequences for harmful or insensitive representation. This might be true. I don't know. But I do question if maybe the backlash that people of color get when they mess up in representation, maybe they get that backlash because it's constantly being preached towards white people and white writers that they need to be so diligent with their research and they can't get anything wrong and they need to get sensitivity readers on board to make sure that their book is sensitive to these other cultures and whatever. So it's like, if they're hearing that all the time, if white authors are hearing that all the time and white people are hearing that all the time, and then you as a person of color mess up representation when you preach to not mess up representation, I can see there being some backlash from people who wouldn't otherwise give it to you. That's just my little two cents there. Next thing is the question of whether or not white people should write main or point of view characters that are people of color. And this author says, the short answer is no. Here's the fact of the matter. A white author will never be able to wholly and meaningfully portray the experiences of a main or POV character of color the way an author of color can. Long answer, sit down, grab a drink, and be prepared to do a lot of work. So maybe if a white author will never be able to wholly and meaningfully portray a main character of color, maybe POC writers should absolutely never ever be allowed to write a white POV character. I don't understand this at all. But the author moves on to the question of, what if the book isn't specifically about the character's ethnicity or culture? And she says, I'm sure this is a question a lot of white authors are yearning to ask. My main character just happens to be Black/Asian/Latinx, etc. But the story isn't actually about being Black, Asian, Latinx, etc. What then? You need to answer the following questions. Why do you want to write this story? Why is it absolutely imperative for you, a white author, to have a main character who isn't white? Is it because you think that a POC protagonist will sell better? If that's your answer, then you need to think long and hard about how you're profiting off of marginalized identities. Not a cute look. Whew. Ah. I'm sure that the people reading this article were definitely planning on writing a person of color character just to profit off of it. I'm sure that's the people that are reading an article like this. Anyway, she goes on and says, next, you need to ask yourself, is it even possible to separate the character from their ethnicity or culture? Even if your book isn't specifically about the character being Black, Asian, etc., that identity is going to affect how your character interacts with the world, especially in novels set in our real world. Are you prepared to do the necessary research and consultations, as well as pay for the mental and emotional labor of POC editors, beta readers, sensitivity readers, and other such content partners? Yeah, so you're getting the gist of the amount of work that you are expected to do as a white writer writing a person of color. Not just a protagonist, I don't think, but like any person of color character, it seems. Moving on to the question of, but the book actually is about the character's ethnicity or culture. What do I do then? And this person says, why do you feel qualified to write this story? No, I'm serious. Sit with that question for a minute. Why do you, a white person, feel like you can accurately, sensitively, and meaningfully portray what is meant to be Nigerian, Puerto Rican, Vietnamese, Native American, Filipino, Taiwanese, or whatever identity it is that you want to write about? In an industry where your work will be given more consideration because everything about you, from your name to your face, is more palatable to the business, why do you feel entitled to tell stories that are not yours? Why? Why do you feel entitled? Yeah, fun stuff. I feel like, you know, I understand it to a certain extent. Like, you don't want people, like, completely butchering the stories of other people. But at the same time, I'm like, how many times have people butchered the stories of other people? It just hasn't been, like, people of opposite race. You know, like, I feel like there's a lot of misrepresentation of people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. There's a lot of really bad period pieces that have been written that, you know, some people who read it will complain about, but nobody really focuses on that. And it's like, well, you're saying it's historical fiction, but it's really not historical because it's completely inaccurate. I feel like that's kind of a big deal, but, you know, whatever. Anyways, this article moves on to the question of, should I write supporting/not point of view characters that are people of color? Short answer, maybe. Long answer, there are a lot of things to consider first. Once again, ask yourself why you're doing this. Beware of white savior mentality. And then I thought this part was particularly interesting. I didn't highlight the whole paragraph, but highlighted this part where the writers address white parents of children of color and says, listen, okay, listen, y'all. You may believe it's your job as a parent to provide your children with the representation they need. You may also have a conviction that having this proximity to a culture qualifies you to write about it. However, marrying into a culture doesn't automatically make you an expert on it. Even if you learn a lot about a culture through meaningful, sustained interaction through your spouse and in-laws, that still does not erase one's white privilege. I was waiting for that term to crop up, you guys. There it is. White privilege. Okay, But yeah, and then she goes on, factual knowledge about a culture is not a substitute for lived experiences of growing up in a culture or being a person of color. Witnessing the racism directed at your child of color firsthand is not the same as experiencing racism yourself. If you are a parent of a multiracial child of color and or an adopted child of color, seek out and support representation written by authors with those backgrounds instead of taking it upon yourself to write it. Even if you are literally a career writer with published work, you must go support other people who are doing what you want to do, and you must not do what you want to do because you're white. Yeah. Okay, cool. That's nice. That's cool. I found this next part also interesting because it's talking about taking into account the specific genre that you're writing in. And going from there as to whether or not you write a person of color into your story. So she says, take into account your specific genre and target age range when writing this. If there aren't any titles with that representation that you're going for, okay, in your part of the publishing market, reconsider writing that representation. You should not be claiming any firsts as a white author. So if somebody of color has not already done what you would like to do, you cannot do it first, according to this article. That's insane. You're not allowed to take that first from the community of people of color, okay? Because what if, hear me out, what if in like 132 years, to be exact, okay, somebody from the specific race and specific gender and specific culture that you want to write a character from and about, okay, finally decides to write a story and get it published. What if that happens? You would have taken that first from them. You would have taken that first from them. Don't do that. Don't do that. That's racist. And then we get into the issue of intersectionality, which is just a whole monster on its own. But the writers of this article say that if there are no books by a trans Taiwanese author in your target marketing category, reconsider writing a trans Taiwanese character. Hire a queer Asian sensitivity reader for a queer Asian character, and do your best to find a match with the same specific combination of queer identities and ethnicities. If you cannot find an appropriate sensitivity reader for your manuscript, put that on the back burner or cut it out entirely. Like, oh my god. Okay. So we get to the kind of conclusion of the article. Still want to write characters of color? Be prepared to do the following. Do as much research as you possibly can do on your own on the cultures you're depicting. Accept criticism of any kind from readers of color without complaint or defensiveness. Okay. Proactively support authors of color in your same genre / target audience and beyond. And in conclusion, at the end of the day, no one can give you blanket permission or a pass to write any marginalized identity, nor can any sensitivity readers guarantee your representation is 100% free of harm or will be positively received. POC are not a monolith, we will disagree. That said, do not use the opinions of those who are permissive to talk over those who are opposed to you writing that experience. So yeah. The first article that we read through, okay, that one is pretty much just like, yeah, you can write, white authors can write people of color characters, but, you know, these are just some racist things they do sometimes when they try. And then this second article is pretty much just like, you're not allowed to write people of color characters. I mean, you can do whatever you want, because ultimately you bear the consequences of your own actions. But you're not really allowed to do that. And most certainly not allowed to make your main character a person of color. Like, that's crazy. That's crazy. But for reference, okay, the two people who worked on this article, one of them is a Filipino blogger who I think is, like, the person who owns this blog that this article was on. And, you know, works in beta reading and sensitivity reading and marketing and all that stuff. Okay. The second one is a queer Taiwanese-American book blogger, fiction writer, and graduate student. They have more than 4 years of experience working as a sensitivity reader, and they have a BA in Asian American Studies and are currently pursuing a dual master degree in children's literature and library and information science. We've just got some more confused people all over the place going into the library world, going into the children's lit world. So if you're a parent, please be paying attention to what your child is reading. And also, if you have children in school, first of all, I would say pull them out, homeschool them. That's always my recommendation. But if you have children in public or private school, you better be checking what those libraries contain, because there is some pretty disgusting stuff that I've been finding out about that's in some of the local public school libraries in Tennessee here that I've been like writing on for my newspaper articles. And oh my God, okay, pay attention to what's going on, guys, because it's just disturbing. Anyways, so those are the two articles that kind of spurred this podcast episode. Ultimately, this is not even close to being a new topic of conversation in the writing community or the reading and literary criticism communities for that matter. I remember having discussions about this stuff when I was enrolled in university English courses. There's all sorts of discussion about this topic in the YouTube community when it comes to, you know, the book people, the booktubers, and the writing people on YouTube. There's lots of discussion about that. There's lots of discussion about it, obviously, in articles online. Like, you can find it anywhere when it comes to the writing, what did they call it in the article? The bookish community? Yes. So this is not new, but in conclusion, I think this idea that in order to correct a flaw in society, we not only have to correct that flaw, but we also have to overcorrect it like the correction is on crack cocaine is ridiculous. It's the same concept that is kind of there in arguments for like reparations and affirmative action and stuff. It's overcorrecting to the point that you're no longer struggling with the initial flaw or problem anymore. You got to a point where things were balanced out, and then you just barreled right past it and kept going, and now you're finding a bunch of little things to pick up and like be like, this is the problem. And I think the only reason that some of these things are like actually an issue for people, that people actually find these things like terrible and racist and offensive, is because they're viewing these things through the lens of what used to be the problem. Like, they're not looking at these things through the lens of how our society actually functions now. Or maybe they are, and they just see it entirely differently than a lot of people. But yeah, you know, yeah. Yeah. Whatever. I just think it's all really stupid, personally. And maybe I'm just talking in circles and nothing I'm saying makes sense, but whatever. What do you guys think about this? Okay. Is it racist if white authors don't write characters of color into their stories? And is it more or less racist if they do write characters of color into their stories, but maybe just not as well as a person of color could have written that character? You should, like, I don't know, let me know what you think in the YouTube comments, or if you're listening to the audio-only version of this podcast episode, you can shoot me a message on Instagram or Facebook at Subtle Rampage Podcast. And, you know, if you're all nice and respectful, even if you disagree with me, I will probably reply. Just, you know, don't call me any mean things or tell me that my hair is the color of a toilet cleaner, and I will respond to you. I hope today's ramblings prompted some thoughts of your own or gave you something interesting to talk about with the unlucky next person that walks into the room. Either way, thank you for tuning into this episode of Subtle Rampage Podcast. If you have not listened to my recent interview with Dr. Michael Schwartz, the author of Fauci's Fiction, How the Government and Modern Medicine Missed the Boat on COVID-19 from Day One, make sure you go check out episode number 32 of the podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation that me and Dr. Schwartz ended up having, and I think you will too. Don't quote me on that, but it was actually really interesting to me. I also recently had the pleasure a few days ago, actually, of hanging out with Steve Abramovich over on the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. So you should go check that out if you like seeing my beautiful face. That was a fun interview. I'll put the link down in the description below. My name is Adelia Kirchner, and I'll be back with some more content for you guys next week.